Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Charleston for this event which celebrates Daphne du Maurier as a short story writer. Du Maurier's short stories are amongst her most haunting works, so unearthing and publishing under the title The Doll, the early lost du Maurier short stories, is a cause for huge celebration, and this evening we are celebrating. We're here to discuss what these works reveal about du Maurier as an author, and we have an incredibly distinguished panel to welcome. So I'm going to start with Polly, who's closest to me. Polly Sampson is an author, journalist, and lyricist, whose first big literary success resulted in her winning a Blue Peter badge, which I think sadly she no longer has. She's also now one of our best contemporary short story writers, author of two collections of short stories and a novel, as well as the writer for the lyrics of two number one albums. Her newest collection of stories, Perfect Lives, is published by Virago, and she has written the introduction to The Doll. Anthony Quinn is a writer and journalist who contributes regularly to The Independent, The Daily Telegraph, The New York Times, The Mail on Sunday, and lots of other titles. Since 1998, he's been film critic for The Independent, and he is currently the wine correspondent for Esquire magazine. Oh, no.
Sadly, no.
Oh, I'm terribly... It just
Sorry
shows.
To disappoint everyone. But
I really admired that. Anyway, his first book, The Rescue Man, was published in 2009, while his latest book, Half the Human Race, is set in London during the early 20th century and takes a look at the suffragette movement, how men and women relate to each other, and cricket. Daisy Godwin, who is here in the red next to Polly, is an award-winning television producer, poetry curator, and best-selling novelist. She's worked as a producer or editor on far too many television programs to mention, but her credits include Jamie's Kitchen, Grand Designs, and Property Ladder. Her first novel, My Last Duchess, was published last year. She has also published 8 best-selling poetry anthologies and a memoir entitled Silver River. She's also the presenter of shows that include Essential Poems to Fall in Love With and Reader, I Married Him. And chairing the panel at the far end is the novelist Kate Pullinger, one of whose first jobs was working in a copper mine in the Yukon, where she crushed rocks for a year. It's all true. She writes for both print and for digital platforms, and her 2009 novel, The Mistress of Nothing, won one of Canada's most prestigious literary prizes, the Governor General's Literary Award for Fiction. Her other books include A Little Stranger, Weird Sister, and When the Monster Dies, as well as the short story collection My Life as a Girl in a Men's Prison. And she co-wrote the novel of the film The Piano with director Jane Campion. What's going to happen is that Polly is going to read one of the stories from The Doll, and then there's going to be a discussion. Anyway, please join me in welcoming our panel. Thank you.
Thank you. I won't read the whole story, because I think it might take a little too long. But what I thought I'd do is read 2 extracts from the title story, The Doll. The first extract is about Rebecca, who is the object of the narrator's fascination, and it's about the first time he sees her play the violin, and I think it's quite interesting for what it tells us about Daphne du Maurier's preoccupations at the time. And she was 20 when she wrote this. She was to play at Vorky's flat the following evening, and I went to hear her. Olga had not exaggerated, with all her palpable, shallow insincerity. I sat like a drugged man, incapable of movement. I don't know what she played, but it was shattering, stupendous. I was not aware of anything but that I and Rebecca were together, one of the world, away, lost in unutterable bliss. We were climbing, then flying, higher, higher. At one time the violin seemed to protest, and it was as if she were refusing me, and I were pursuing her. Then there came a torrent of sound, a medley of acceptance and denial, a confusion of notes in which were mingled desire and sweetness and intolerable pleasure. I could feel my heart beating like the throb of some mighty vessel, and the blood pounded in my temples. Rebecca was part of me. She was myself. It was too much. It was too glorious. We had reached the summit. We could go no further. The sun seemed to strike into my eyes. I looked up. Rebecca was smiling at me. The violin broke on a note of exquisite beauty. It was fulfillment. I leant back exhausted on the sofa, my senses swimming. It was too wonderful, too wonderful. 3 minutes passed before I became fully conscious again. I felt as if I had plunged in the black abyss of eternity to sleep and had come awake once more. I don't think she's talking about her playing the violin at all. And then I thought I'd just read a little section where we get to meet the doll of the title. Then she rose and went slowly across the room to the door I had never yet seen opened. She looked oddly pale as she stood there, her mass of queer, savage hair springing from her head, her hand on the knob of the door. "I want to introduce you to Giulio," she said. I left my chair and went towards her. I had no idea of what she was talking about. She took my hand and then opened the door. I saw a low, round-shaped room whose walls were draped with some sort of velvet hangings as if to deaden any sound, and long, thick curtains were drawn across the window. There was a log fire, but it had burnt very low. Near the fireplace was a divan covered with cushions thrown anyhow, and the only light came from a small, shaded lamp, thus leaving the room in a half-darkness. There was one chair in the room, and this was facing the divan. Something was sitting in the chair. I felt an eerie, cold feeling in my heart, as if the room were haunted. "What is it?" I whispered. Rebecca took the lamp and held it over the chair. "This is Giulio," she said softly. I stepped closer and saw what I took to be a boy of about 16, dressed in a dinner jacket, shirt and waistcoat and long Spanish trousers. His face was the most evil thing I have ever seen. It was ashen pale in colour, and the mouth was a crimson gash, sensual and depraved. The nose was thin with curved nostrils, and the eyes were cruel, gleaming and narrow and curiously still. They seemed to stare straight through one, the eyes of a hawk. The hair was sleek and dark, brushed right back from the white forehead. It was the face of a satyr, a grinning, hateful satyr. Then I was aware of a strange feeling of disappointment, a helpless sensation and not understanding of dumb incredulity. There was no boy sitting in the chair. It was a doll, human enough, damnably lifelike, with a foul, distinctive personality. But a doll. Only a doll. The eyes stared into mine without recognition. The mouth leered foolishly. I looked at Rebecca. She was watching my face. "I don't see," I said. "What's the point of all this? Where did you get this loathsome toy? Are you having a joke with me?" I spoke sharply. I felt uneasy and cold. The next moment, the room was in darkness. She had turned out the lamp. I felt her arms around my neck and her mouth upon mine.
Well, I'll just start just by mentioning that if you hadn't read the book and you're a Du Maurier fan, you really must. The story is, you know, recently rediscovered out of archives from old magazines. Sort of things that have been hidden away and lost really for most of the 20th century. And what's extraordinary about the stories, and in particular the doll, the one that. You're reading from just now, Polly, is that she wrote these stories when she was very young indeed, 20,
yes.
Only 20 years old. And yet, as you read the collection, you see so many of her themes, so many of the things that she was preoccupied throughout her writing life coming up in kind of almost sort of embryonic form, really. The uncanny, certainly the creepy. I mean, the doll is an extremely weird story.
I was thinking, just listening to Polly read it, was that is the doll somehow, does it kind of represent male sexuality for her?
Yes.
Because didn't you think that?
And shame. I think it represents that she wrote it at the time that she was having a slightly incestuous relationship with her 22 years older cousin.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of shame associated in any case with all of her relationships because her father was very jealous and rather obsessed with her. And so I think Giulio represents a sort of shame about sexuality. And it's also written at a time when sex aids, I think vibrators were just being advertised in things like, you know, Women and Home and Needlecraft magazine.
That's an interesting combination.
Practical Needlecraft. I've seen the picture. And so, you know, I was fascinated by the idea of a male, because he's a male sex toy. I mean, she implies it. She never quite writes it, but he's operated by mechanical parts, and I was just wondering which bits of him were operated by mechanical parts. And there was no such thing in the 20s, and I mean, I don't know, I mean, there probably is now. I'm far too innocent to know such things, but it is an extraordinary thing for this very young girl from an upper-class background to have dreamt up and to have written about.
Yes, absolutely. And you say in your introduction that she had to sort of get away from London in order to write. Yeah. She grew up in Hampstead, but she was always drawn to Cornwall, yeah. And that it wasn't until this difficult phase of her life she got herself away and began to write these stories.
Yeah. I mean, her home life was full of her father's obsession. So any time she tried to get away to do anything, whether it was to write or to see her boyfriend, that she would come home to this sort of port-fueled rage, you know, where have you been, really? And he used to sit at Cannon Hall in a room at the top and watch her from the top. And actually that comes in again I think, the best story in this collection, which is called East Wind, which is where a husband sees his wife's infidelity and he's standing on top of the hill. And when you sort of think about, she's written about this relationship with her cousin Gerald, and when there's an incident where her father sees them kissing from on top of the hill, and it's just so fascinating to be able to put these early experiences into the places of the story.
Where was it published, The Doll? I mean,
The Doll was never published.
Not in Needlecraft.
No. I mean, actually, that must have been a terrible experience for her, that you know, she finished it with the hope of publication and then no one would.
Mm. I think you can tell that they're very early stories, though, can't you?
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
I'm Polly made that story actually sound more interesting than it actually is, I think. they're real juvenilia, and I think that Virago done her a slight disservice actually publishing them, because they, when you read them after her mature period, great stories, I think they look very, very thin and very stagey.
But they're sort of fascinating. I think you have to read them for a different reason. I think if you read it with Myself When Young,
yes,
sort of, if you read the two things together, I think they're really fascinating. And I think East Wind's her
memoir,
good story.
If you read it with her
If you read it with her memoir, right. Which only covers up to the point of her marriage, up to her marriage, which I think when she was 22, mm-hmm. You know, and so it's absolutely this period.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes them much more interesting. And
but if you came to Du Maurier for the first time through this book, you'd think, this is kind of, it's juvenilia, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't
but
really
juvenilia is fascinating.
But that's one thing I wanted to hear from each of you, actually, is, you know, what's your readerly relationship with Du Maurier like? When did you first read her? Did you read her when you were young and reappraise her later? Or I'd just like to hear that from each of you.
Well, actually, I came to Du Maurier very late. I didn't read her as a young woman. I started reading her, I think, sort of I passed my 40th birthday, even. And I find it very interesting. I'd always sort of slightly dismissed her as women's fiction, you know, which a rich thing to say. But I'd always thought it was something that, you know, I was very high-minded as a teenager, and I didn't think she was worth reading. And actually now, I think she's fantastic. Very interesting novelist. Not all her books are wonderful. There are some that are much, much better than others, but I think the good ones are really extraordinary. Mm. And she writes, she's not totally in command of her subconscious, which I think is what's so fascinating about her. You know, there are themes going on. She's obviously a compulsive writer, but there are things that are coming out that you feel that she's not totally in command of, and that's what makes her so exciting, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not formulaic in any way. Her books don't, you don't know what's going to happen. They're not all the same. There is none, you know, I've just been reading about Georgette Heyer, who is a completely different kind of novelist and who produces the same book again and again and again. Very good. Her life, I've just read her biography, is incredibly boring. Du Maurier is as if her life is every bit as exciting as her books, and as sort of puzzling and mysterious.
Yeah, definitely. What about you, Polly?
Well, I grew up in Cornwall, so she was compulsory reading even when she was out of fashion. But I do find it odd that she's thought of as a romantic women's writer. I mean, when you think about books like, you know, Julius.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's about the Prussian War. It's it's kind of gory. It's about incest. Why is that? Why was she categorised as a romantic writer?
I think there is
so little romance in many of her books.
Precisely. I mean, I think it's just because she was a woman.
Yeah,
you know,
and she sneered at terribly.
Yes.
Have
yeah, well, I must say, I was probably one of those males who did sneer at the idea of Daphne du Maurier. I started reading her about 2 months ago. but I realised that I admired her by default because I read straight away when I knew I was doing this event, the Birds and Don't Look Now, which are, you know, two of the great sort of modern films, modern post-war films, and to read them and then compare them with the movies, they're so very different, and yet you can see the kernel of this kind of great gothic, tragic, macabre drama going on. I think she's absolutely brilliant, to be honest, and I feel rather ashamed of myself that I didn't get to know her before now.
She's one of those writers who, you know, a lot of writers, great writers, that the books aren't as good as the films, but the films aren't as good as the books, but what's interesting about du Maurier is that in every case, I think the films have been they've been better than the original work. I mean, I don't know about Rebecca. Rebecca is a kind of, you know, thing. But, like, Don't Look Now, I just read that coming down on the train. The film is a masterpiece.
Yes.
And there's so much that Rogue has expanded from...
Well, for instance, probably the most famous sex scene in all movies between Donald... Well, it's just a sort of sentence, isn't it?
Yes.
And then they pass over it. That's, you know, that's the unfortunate thing about her adaptations. The most famous things in Hitchcock's films aren't hers. So it's the attack of the birds in The Birds when Tibby Hedren's sort of being sort of assaulted by these things. And then the sex scene in Don't Look Now, and also the sight. I don't know whether anybody in the audience feels this, but I've never been able to look at a child in a red duffel coat the same way. You know, I'd never go pursuing anyone around the Venice.
The red coat is there,
but it's. But it's worn by the wife. That's the weird thing in the story.
There's also a small figure who he thinks.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Wearing a red coat.
Yes.
There are two red coats.
But for the pure reveal of the last scene of Don't Look Now, I mean, it's.
However, the birds. I would argue that the story is every bit as good as
the film, but
it's just completely different.
Yeah,
and someone should make the birds.
British.
And she didn't like the adaptation of.
I don't blame her. I mean, it's a sort of wonderful film, but it's so not related to her story.
The birds. We should make clear that the birds, written by du Maurier, was actually set in a Cornish village, and Hitchcock read it very quickly, forgot all about it, and then decided later that he was going to make it into a film and changed it to Marin County in California and made it into this kind of Freudian melodrama. But he just wanted it as a piece of visual storytelling. He wasn't really interested in the kind of the whys and the wherefores. He just wanted to, as ever, just film this terrifying story, and he did a great job, but it's not the story.
And the story ends so bleakly.
I mean, they don't get away.
The world ends, and, and the birds.
But you think it's the case that for most readers, in the most, you know, the broad readership of du Maurier, actually, it's the novels that are the things that really endure for readers, that people return to Rebecca, especially, as well as some of the others, and that the stories are less known in many cases. I, for one, didn't know for a long time that The Birds and Don't Look Now were written by Daphne du Maurier. Mm. It was only when I read Margaret Forster's biography of du Maurier that sort of...
Yeah, I think she'd adapted them herself, but she never did. I mean, she wrote a couple of plays, but she never did a film script, I don't think. They were always handed on to somebody else, maybe because she didn't want to, but she got paid a lot of money for them. Got paid a huge amount for Rebecca. This is in 1940, and, you know, it won the best picture at the Academy Awards. So. Mm.
And is it the novels that endure for you as readers as well? My
favourite is a story. It's the Apple Tree. I think I'd put that above any of the novels.
And why is that, Polly?
It's just so spooky. It's so brilliantly written. And it's it's succinct, it's got everything I want from the story, and I think the novels, I really enjoy them, but I find myself picking fault with so much. They're very long, the novels, and in a way, it's a terrible thing to say about him, but I think she could have really done with a good editor.
Well, I discovered to my amazement that at the time that Du Maurier was writing, there wasn't such a thing as an editor. Authors used to, they were bought, they buy the first book, and if you were a successful novelist, you'd then just send in your manuscript, and they would send it straight off to the printers.
Really?
Yeah, and, that was it. So that there wasn't this sort of sense of, a guiding intelligence sort of crossing bits out. That only came sort of later as a kind of result of American editors.
So this is post-war?
Mm. Yeah, it's sort of 30s and 40s.
Right.
And someone like Georgette Heyer used to just literally send it off. They'd go straight to the printer, and sometimes she'd write and say, "But you know, if somebody from the publishing firm could actually have a look at the script, I'm a bit worried about the ending." And nobody could find the time. It was just extraordinary. Mm. So things have changed.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I do love Rebecca, and it is a book that I reread, which is unusual for me. I'm not a great rereader. I always feel there's too many books out there that I haven't read. And I think one of the reasons why I return to it is that it's a book that's sort of full of enigma and mystery and things that I don't quite understand. And I was trying to think of other... I mean, for me, that's a really interesting quality in any writers, and I think that it's another favorite novel of mine, The Great Gatsby, is similar in that it's weird and it's got mysterious things that don't quite add up in it, and that's part of what allows me to return to it. And I just wondered if any of you...
Well, I think what's interesting about Du Maurier is especially that novel, is how many other works it's inspired.
Absolutely, yeah,
I mean,
that's very interesting.
I read a very interesting book by Justine Picardy, which is called Becoming Daphne. It's called Daphne or something, and it's all based on Rebecca, and it's kind of got a double narrative. Half of it's about Du Maurier herself, mm-hmm. and half of it's about set in the present, but Rebecca is the framework of, the story of the wife that isn't there, but there's before... I mean, I think Before She Met Me, the Julian Barnes novel owes a debt to Rebecca, and there is a sequel, wasn't there? Somebody wrote a sequel to Rebecca as well. So I think the thing about that book is that it's really inspired people, because as you say, all the ends have not been tied up, and it is just one of those things, and it comes from a place from her, which is quite weird too, because of course she wrote it. And then she moved into Menabilly, the wonderful house that she rented from the Rashley family. And of course, after 25 years, after she'd written all her books there and she'd lived there, loved the place passionately and wanted to buy it, and they said, "No, your lease is up and you have to leave." And of course, it was just like leaving Menabilly. It was the end. So the way in which her art prefigured her life in that book is really astonishing.
I think it's astonishing that the Happy Valley, the story in here.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely. Yes, anyone who loves Rebecca needs to read that story.
Yes,
she went and her parents had bought a house in Foy, and she and her sister went at 5 o'clock one morning to trespass around Menabilly when you were not allowed to go. And the story, The Happy Valley, is about that feeling of looking at it and knowing that that's where she belonged. And it also has a sort of wonderful piece of her of writing where she's sort of experiencing her past, her present, and her future all at the same time and in two sentences. And that's something that she comes back to again, in The Loving Spirit, mm-hmm. when Janet Coombe meets her son in the churchyard as an adult.
Yeah. But one of the unusual things I think about Du Maurier is how closely associated she is with Cornwall in a kind of way that is more common with North American writers, where they're perceived to be regional in specific ways, and that doesn't happen so much with English writers.
Oh, I don't know. There's the Brontes.
True. Yeah. Here we had
Kate Clancy's. I was going to say, actually, I think the Brontes and Du Maurier are very closely connected. I mean, she wrote the Infernal World of Bramwell Bronte, which is very interesting. About Bramwell, the Bronte brother, was the first to die, she got quite excited about the idea that he might have written Wuthering Heights, which is a route that a lot of sort of Bronte nuts go down, and she became a bit of a Bronte nut for a while. And like, you know, in the same way that Jane Eyre inspired by the Sargasso Sea, you know, because there is so much going on up in the attic, as it were. I think that's that, that. I think that's the same as Rebecca. You know, that it, people want to kind of finish it off, don't they? Mm.
The great thing about Rebecca, it's you can't really pin it down because it's a sort of ghost story, but it's also a suspense story. It's a thriller. It's a kind of murder mystery. It's got all these things going on. I'm afraid I'm only talking about the film, but not having read the book.
In the book, of course, he does kill her, doesn't he?
And of course, and it's inspired by her retrospective jealousy of her husband's girlfriend before he met her.
And this shows how wrong-headed Hitchcock was, because he actually wanted to have the part of Rebecca in the film, which I think would have just destroyed the whole element of it. I mean, it would have stood, you know, it would have turned it into something different and I think worse. And David Selznick, his producer, just said, no, it's just got to start after Rebecca has died, because it's not going to be the same story otherwise. And Hitchcock, thank God, was overruled.
Did Maria like the film?
She liked Rebecca, yeah, she did. And I think she probably liked the $50,000 that it came with as well. Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific film. In fact, I'm now quite inspired to read Rebecca. It sounds great. I'm being converted right on the stage.
Be turned.
And presumably she never saw Don't Look Now. She was...
She would have done, she died in 1989, didn't she?
Oh, right,
so
of course,
so
yeah.
she would have done. I mean, it came out, Don't Look Now, the stories came out in 71, and the film came out in 73, I think.
Right.
So, you know, she would have been perfectly, ready to watch it. But what she thought of The Birds, I couldn't find out. I gather she didn't like it. I've just got to say, actually, this is my favourite ever film review. It's just the four words, and it was in a TV kind of roundup of it was just an anonymous writer who talked about The Birds. It, four words: leave no turn unstoned. which I think is just absolutely brilliant, and I wish I could write a review like that.
And do you think that filmmakers, contemporary filmmakers, will be drawn yet again to Du Maurier?
I'm sure they will.
I bet there's nothing that isn't optional.
But they've remade Rebecca, haven't they, as well?
Yeah. With Lever as well.
When they it's been remade a couple of times, hasn't it?
Yeah, Amelia Fox. Isn't it?
And Frenchman's Creek they're always doing. And my cousin Rachel, actually, I've forgotten about that's one of my absolute favourites.
That's my favourite novel.
I think so too.
Clever.
Because
you never do. You know, because the dog likes Rachel. And when you know that Daphne loves dogs, you would think that she would give the dog the right to judge whether the woman was evil or...
But it is completely brilliant. I remember hearing that on the radio when I was about seven and just thinking this was it. It's astonishingly good. You read it, it's really...
Yeah.
The Laburnum Seeds.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. But one of the things that sort of interests me and puzzles me with Du Maurier and her enduring, the way she's so beloved of readers... Du Maurier readers are usually obsessed with her life story as well. The two things seem to mesh in the public perception of Du Maurier, which isn't always the case. I mean, I certainly knew nothing about Georgette Heyer.
There's nothing to know. I'm just
you're able to report.
I'm afraid I've read the biography. There's really nothing to say. The royalty checks didn't come in on time, which was quite annoying.
But that always strikes me as a strange thing with a writer when their life becomes their biography becomes very important to their work. And I just wondered what...
I didn't realise that going to Venice was her private code for having a lesbian sexual adventure, for instance.
Venetian.
Who knew? Not me.
And why?
I've no idea.
Gondolas.
Presumably canals.
Death in Venice, I've heard of, but sex in Venice. Well, who knows? Who knows? But Venetian and going to Venice was her little. But I gather she struggled with her sexual leanings considerably.
She didn't struggle that hard. I mean, she had a full-on affair with Gertie.
Mm.
I think she was just incredibly highly sexed, and I think that that comes... I mean, you know, if you look at that section I read from the doll, and, you know, she was very attractive to men and women, and she was attracted to men and women, and... And I think part of the reason that people always want to know about the biography is that her subconscious is screaming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And because she's such an instinctive writer, she does nothing to quiet her subconscious. She just lets it scream on the page. Mm. And that leads you to, you know, to look for the turmoil that created.
And she's one of those writers who, I mean, she didn't really have any formal education, did she?
She went to French finishing school, but I don't know.
But, I mean, she didn't kind of go to university, so she'd never really sort of learned to kind of, you know, to step back from that. And I think, again, that's what makes her so...
intuitive.
Yes, yes.
And that's why people are so interested in her, because of such an interesting life, and, as you say, so close to the surface in the books and stories.
Yeah. And she's very funny. I mean, we mustn't forget, you know, I mean, you know, she's written off as a romantic novelist, and then a lot of us appreciate the darkness. But even at the age of 19, 20, 21, some of these did make me laugh out loud. Yeah. I mean, she is very funny.
The couple who go have their honeymoon in it.
Yes, that was
good. Yeah. I quite enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
And do you think that she would be pleased to see these stories published now?
No.
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 I don't think anyone.
Frankly, no.
Was she concerned with reputation? Was that something?
Yes, she was deeply hurt.
I can't imagine
her entire life that she was written off as a romantic novelist. Mm-hmm. And I think she used to write to her whenever she delivered a manuscript and say, maybe this is the one that will get me a serious review.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she does write in her diaries a lot of hatred about people who've kind of written her off or written her sort of slightly scathing reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And she really cared about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, she had, you know, incredible success in her lifetime, but actually not what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of begs the question of the movies and the kinds of material that is made into movies. I was trying to think of other writers who've had a succession of interesting movies made of their
books.
Stephen King. I was thinking of James M. Cain and Philip K. Dick.
But I was just thinking of Stephen King because he's like Du Maurier in a weird sense, because all his novels are rather different, except they all kind of obviously come from quite a dark place. Mm. You know, that's...
And they have a sort of sensationalist
edge to them. Yes, they do. And it's odd. I mean, you wouldn't think of them in the same breath, but actually they have more in common than you would imagine.
Yeah, but I think also with all four of the writers that I just mentioned, that there is this thing about them being perceived as on the pulp side of...
But that pulp thing is just... You know, actually, readers, you know, they're all enormously popular. And I don't know about James and Ken, but the others are all being read, they're all still in print.
Definitely.
You know, so I think that's the sort of distinction that, you know, that people make on the literary pages. I don't know whether readers worry about that as much, do you think? I don't know.
No, I think she's a much loved writer, and that's...
And she's brilliant.
Well, why don't we open up to questions from the audience? There is I don't know why we're getting feedback, but there is a...
Whoa.
It's a theremin.
There is a roving mic.
Well, all of us.
Yeah.
Now he tells us.
Oh, I thought, yeah, okay.
Right.
So there is a roving microphone, and I did see one hand up.
Okay, sorry, I'm just...
How's that? How's that as a sound?
Yeah.
Are you there, Moriarty?
So the roving mic, there is a question up here at the front. Maybe we'll abandon the mic.
No, there's a lady here.
All right, okay.
Why don't you just ask us?
I'll repeat it.
I really wanted to explain the short stories, I think they are really astonishing. We have recently read all of them in our reading group, and the doll you read about is truly amazing, I think.
Yeah.
She wrote this aged 20, I think at a time when Freud was not yet known, not in England, was in the continent, and she kind of has this amazing reversal of gender roles. Now, the sex toy was known for men, for men.
Yes.
And it's beginning, as you say. There is this incredible story, and of course we wonder whether she was, what she knew about it. Oscar Koschka.
Oh, yes.
Painter, who was in love with Anna Maria, who then...
Hello. Is that better?
So, yeah.
Who had a child by him, a love child, and aborted it. And Kokoschka couldn't bear this idea. And he had somebody make a doll in the shape of Alma, and he lived with his doll. So that is actually another kind of story. But, of course, it is the man having...
Yes, wasn't that later?
I think it was probably later. But there must be other examples. So she's very, very special to have this woman who, you know, she sees the story through the eyes of a man who adores this woman, and the woman who actually adores her sex. So really, I just want to say these stories are really extraordinary, and I don't think they are weak at all.
No. but they're weak compared to her best stories.
Yeah. They're
I mean, they're fantastic. They're as juvenilia and as a key for understanding her as a writer. I think they're really brilliant and they're really worth reading. But I would imagine that it would be true that she would be horrified if she were alive that many of those had been published, because her standard went, you know, much higher.
And so you could have saved her from being exposed to this.
Well, I don't know, but maybe she would have found it interesting and amusing.
Maybe,
But and actually, they are all still proper stories, you know, they are sort of well constructed.
Yeah, for a 20-year-old, they are amazing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have to say, you know, we've all been a bit dismissive, but frankly, if I'd written those stories,
I think they prove that a writer is born and not made.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
Yeah. Another question? Sarah?
Well, it's not so much a question, but just to support my friend here, that I think that I don't see why she should be ashamed of them, because she worked... all my knowledge is based on the Margaret Foster biography, but she worked incredibly hard to get them published. She refused to have the very first one she wrote, the one about the vicar and the abortion, and what I can't remember the title. Someone offered to publish it, but she stuck to her guns and refused to have it published without any... she wouldn't accept to have changes. And I think she should... Well, I don't know enough about her. I haven't researched into her. But I would say that I don't think she would have any reason to be ashamed.
Only because her later stories are so much better.
Yes, well, of course. But, I mean, writers must accept their whole world.
Well, especially dead ones.
Dead ones. And I just one other small point to make, which, again, comes from the biography, that it isn't true that her work wasn't edited. There was some poor woman at Golang's who
Sheila
had to
Hockies.
Rewrite the whole thing because she couldn't spell, and her grammar was appalling. And it may be that she couldn't cut it, and once she'd become a famous writer, then of course, as any publisher knows, it's almost impossible
to do anything.
She did, in fact. There was someone who was slaving away.
Copy editing, doing.
No, Sheila Hodges. She did deliver to Sheila Hodges, and Sheila Hodges did a lot of. You know, she was quite a tautologist writer, and so Sheila Hodges did, you know, cross bits out, and they did to have a lot of correspondence, and Daphne did not take well to any edits.
No, she didn't like it, but they did try and do it, and I think Victor Golang started doing it, and then he passed it on to his female subordinate. Plus ça change.
There's one over here. There's a few at the back as well, which is harder to see.
Yes, I mean, sadly, I haven't yet read the stories, but as presumably you all have, I'd just like to know what I'm interested in is what are the themes that you think that she had already touched upon in these early stories, which she then took on and improved on, let's say, in her later work? What do you think the main themes and
sexual frustration?
Sexual jealousy, I think.
Sexual jealousy, without question.
But also a deep love of the landscape, a deep, you know, a great ability to evoke landscape as well.
But also a huge amount of cynicism. I mean, for someone so young, I mean, when you read these stories, she is under no illusions of a happy ending or Prince Charming coming sailing by, which he did. But, you know, they give a very, very jaundiced view of love and marriage.
They're not the work of a romantic novelist at all. No, they are very sort of depressed about, you know, very cynical, as you say, about marriage.
Well, there are two about prostitutes, aren't there? Which are actually, I think, they're the best in the book.
Do you like them?
And I think they're quite sort of risque and sort of rather interesting.
I didn't like those.
I think they would be, you know, her father had a lot of chorus girls and you know, the family were expected to turn a blind eye.
I thought she'd read of Human Bondage. I thought there was a bit of Somerset Maugham.
It might also help to know that Gerald du Maurier was Daphne's father, and he was an actor manager, wasn't he? One of the great actor managers in the
early 90s. A really wonderful actor.
Yeah.
And that, again, for a daughter trying to understand her life and her family, to go and see her father playing all these roles, to then have a father who came home and continued playing these roles. You know, she was a very, very watchful child. There's one bit in Myself When Young where she just sort of mentions it in passing that she bit her nails so bad that she needed medical attention. I mean, you feel her as a young child just watching, trying to make sense of what is going on in that household.
And Olivier says that, but that
definitely.
Olivier says that to Joan Fontaine in the movie, stop biting your nails. Just sort of slaps her.
Have you read Trilby? Has anyone read Trilby, the novel written by her grandfather, greatest bestseller of its age? I mean, it was the thing that, you know, there was this great conversation with Henry James where he tells him about the plot of Trilby, and he offers it to Henry James as a plot, and Henry James says, nah, it's too much action for that. And so he goes off and writes it, and it becomes the most successful novel of the, you know, of the decade.
Late Victorian.
It was extraordinary. But, of course, Svengali is a figure who sort of turns up in du Maurier's fiction. So it's quite an interesting, you know, it's quite an interesting, there is a hangover. I mean, I haven't read the whole book, but I've read some of it, and there's quite an interesting sort of a throughput, actually, which you could almost see in the doll.
What is a throughput?
I don't know. It was just a word that popped into my
inventing language, even as we speak.
The ink.
But there's also the tantalising thing in the doll, which is the woman is called Rebecca.
Yes.
Which does mislead you, because when you look, she's from Eastern Europe. She wears a little cap on her head and has sort of a mix, and she's not at all. But you're rather disappointed, because you come across Rebecca at the beginning, and you're hooray, and then it really isn't. But it's interesting that she picks the same name for the object of obsession.
Very interesting. So it's definitely, all those themes are definitely there in this collection. There was a question at the back.
This sounds a bit like the question at the end of Gardner's Question Time, but I was wondering if any of you had a story that you thought would make a good film that hasn't been made.
Daphne du Maurier story. I don't know that the doll. I think the doll is almost too.
Oh, I think it could be.
I think East Wind. I think the one on the island. That would make it. You could see Lars von Trier kind of getting to work with that.
Yes.
A lot of wind and.
He's certainly got a lot of wind. Yes. There's also one in the Don't Look Now collection. I can't remember what it's called. It's something like Kiss Me Again, Stranger, which is basically about the first story I ever read about a female serial killer, which is really spooky. Again, it could be expanded into a great film, I think. She goes around slaying airmen, air pilots, because her boyfriend or her father was killed in the war, and therefore she feels driven to avenge herself by stabbing all the ermine she can come across.
Oh, wow, I haven't read that.
It's great. And again, it's macabre. She's so,
oh, yes,
she's so wonderfully
brilliant.
Macabre.
Yes.
It's fantastic. And she, yeah, she
yes.
lures this guy and he escapes and it's terrific.
And then he finds, and she says that she sleeps on the grave.
Mm, yeah,
it would be a great
It's
film.
Deeply
yeah.
weird and yeah. warped and yeah. sick, actually.
Yeah.
Which is what we all want.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Well, another question? Oh, there's one right down at the front here.
I was thinking two things, really, that sexual jealousy can be a byproduct of sexual objectification by a parent or as a child, and I wonder if she had, obviously, unresolved stuff that, like you say, kind of seeped through into her writing that wasn't necessarily resolved in a way that we might resolve things now.
Well, when, I mean, there's a very... I find it quite chilling that... She writes after, so she has starts an affair with her cousin, who's 22 years older, when started with holding hands under a blanket when she was 14. And she then, at about the age of 19, they start to have a kissing relationship. And she writes in Myself When Young that it feels very much like kissing her father. And that made me feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah. He looked like the father, and it was also... Handsome and debonair. I mean, I don't know. Are you asking whether she might there might have been some abuse?
Yeah. I mean, it's thought.
Yeah. There's thought. I think there's something going on. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. He was. You know, there were three sisters, and she was the only one. It appears who really interested him. Very special.
Another question? I can't quite see.
Oh, right at the back.
Okay.
Hi, I was just asking, you were saying earlier she didn't really seem like a romantic writer at all, and this is the first sort of stories that I've read of hers. She seems to me a bit more like a sort of very much like a horror author almost, and from the other things you described. I was wondering if you thought she did fit into a genre, or if she sort of transcends genre as a writer completely.
I think she's sui generis, because, I mean, some of her books are classic historical novels, you know, Benjamin's Creek, and some of them are suspense, like My Cousin Rachel, which is brilliantly, it's a historical suspenseful novel. Rebecca, I don't know what you'd call Rebecca. I mean,
it was all sorts, isn't it? I mean, it just, it's a genre hopper.
It's a page turner as well.
I think the Brontes are always kind of, I mean, I think she's, there's a throughput from her. there's a thread from the Brontes to Du Maurier, I think. And I'd say that they are sui generis, aren't they? Because they're sort of, you know, they come from a very different place to, you know, the genteel world of Jane Austen, and yet. But they're not women's fiction, are they? So it's a fascinating thing.
I was surprised to find myself thinking of Poe as I was reading these stories, which I wonder if...
Yeah, sinister.
Yeah, I wonder if Du Maurier had read Poe. She
but also, I think Roald Dahl had definitely read Du Maurier, His adult stories, they feel very connected to
She names Catherine Mansfield and Du Maupassant as her influences, but who knows what else she...
Other questions?
Yes, because you did say you had...
I just wondered if it was the ultimate slight, really, to release these juvenile stories that, having not had success, you know, not had a critical success in her lifetime, and sort of kind of...
I don't think any writers think they've had enough success. I mean, you know, I mean, hello, she was top of... Yes, I think the question was the lady was asking whether Du Maurier would think it was the ultimate slight that these short stories have been reissued when she hadn't had the praise and the claim that she should have had when she was alive.
That's it in a nutshell.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I think it's a compliment that you know, everything that she has written will find its way
between paper covers. I mean, and that is a great testament to her.
But is that what every writer wants?
Well, you know, maybe
a writer who starts out as this kind of furiously driven, energetic kitchen table writer, which she seems to have done. Would you want that actually out in, you know, between covers in later life? Well, posthumously in this case. I think it does a slight disservice to her.
I'm quite sure she would have wanted to be read there.
Right.
So I think what she would have been thrilled about is the fact that, you know, this room is full of people who obviously came here to admire Tony Soup, but also to think about Du Maurier. That must have been that would have been a huge thrill for her because, you know, she was possibly a bit marginalised. I mean, she wasn't sort of in the literary canon, but actually her books are still in print. I mean, she's much more influential now than you might expect from the way she was treated at the time.
Mm. She's the best-selling Virago writer.
Yeah, is she? Yeah.
Really?
That's strange. Better than Angela Carter.
I believe so, yes. Well, maybe it's... Yes, because Angela Carter's in Virago Classics. Yeah, she's the bestseller.
I think Du Maurier will go on and on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah. I think as long as, you know, if she were alive, if they were published in the way that they've been published, which is to say that they are interesting for what they tell us about the development of the writer, I don't think she would have minded at all. Mm. I think if they were published as, you know, straight off as a book of marvellous Du Maurier stories, I think that might be a little bit more problematic.
Mm. Yeah. I think sometimes you can spare a writer their reputation. I think you can be kinder to them by leaving things out rather than putting everything in. That's all. It's interesting developmentally, and that's about it, I'd say.
You see, I think East Winds and the Doll would stand up to anything.
I think so too. I think you're being a bit hard on them, but also I think a lot of people will. I don't think it'd stop you reading other Du Maurier.
No, it won't.
More Du Maurier if this was your first encounter.
Well, that was my first encounter, and then I realised that Chu, in fact, was a really great writer. So
okay. Yeah.
But it's available at the back of the barn here if you'd like to investigate for yourselves.
No, I don't think so. No. Sorry, just...
Tony, you said early on that some of the most memorable scenes in the Du Maurier adaptations actually come from things that she didn't appear in the book,
yes,
or were just a glancing sentence. I wonder if, I mean, you know, I'll start with you, but all the panel members, as this is a short story festival, also might like to say, is there anything about short stories and what they leave out that makes them particularly amenable to film adaptation?
Yes, I think that's interesting, actually. I mean, one of the great modern films for me is Brokeback Mountain, which is an Annie Proulx short story. I think it's great. I think a director and a good screenwriter can... I think it's much more useful to them, in fact, to be able to just take this one little chunk of prose and develop it in their own way, rather than try and cram in, you know, a 270-page novel in a sort of unsatisfactory way, which displeases all of its readers and its fans. So in Du Maurier's case, you know, I think it was just a perfect meeting of a great short story writer and a director, Hitchcock, who was out of this world, and we'll never, ever have another director like him.
I think her short stories are like, you know, like those Japanese tea balls, which when you put them in water, they kind of expand. And I think that's what happens with, you know, the compression of a short story. But a great director can turn them to flower in a most magical way. And actually, you know, I think that's
what right.
And you're absolutely right about Brokeback Mountain. It's more than the sum of its parts.
Mm.
Probably should unfortunately wind it up there, but I just want to thank our panel for the most wonderful discussion, fascinating discussion, to thank Polly in particular for a great reading. I don't think Practical Needlecraft will be the same for any of us after this, and neither perhaps will be going on holiday to Venice. We've succeeded in persuading Anthony, converting Anthony to the idea of actually reading some of Daphne du Maurier's novels, which is great. I hope that we've persuaded you that these early stories really are fascinating and deserve our attention, regardless perhaps of whether or not Daphne du Maurier herself might have been horrified about their publication. you've now got, as Anthony said, the chance to buy copies of The Doll and Other Stories at the back, but also you've got the chance to buy copies of books by all of our authors on the panel and to continue the discussion with them there. But in the meantime, please join me in thanking once again Polly Sampson, Anthony Quinn, Daisy Goodwin and Kate Pullinger. Thank you very much. And actually, we're going to leave the stage. If you could just remain seating while we come through the crowd, and then I can get a drink for all the panelists, and then you can come and buy their books. Thank you.